Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm David Bowes, your host. Over the years in my radio career, I've interviewed staff from the Discovery Institute on a range of topics, including intelligent design and problems with evolutionary theory. It was not uncommon for me to receive email after one of these interviews from people citing a website that claimed to feature countless examples of Darwinian processes producing large-scale biological change. That website was Talk Origins. Specifically, Talk Origins Speciation FAQ, Frequently Asked Questions. The Discovery Institute's Casey Luskin took a look at the studies that they were actually citing and found that the claims weren't nearly as strong as some would have us believe. Casey, you took a look at these claims of speciation. Why don't we take a look at some of the individual examples that we're told are supposed to be so powerful? Let's start with what everybody seems to start with in this conversation, fruit flies.
Yeah, fruit fly experiments have been very common over the last 50, 60 years, 70 years among evolutionary biologists who are trying to study morphological change in the lab. Obviously, fruit flies reproduce pretty rapidly. They're very well understood. They've been studied extensively, so we know their morphology. We know when you found something new, and you know, you can play with them, try to get them to mate, and do all kinds of interesting experiments. So yeah, there were lots of studies cited by the Talk Origins FAQ, almost maybe even a majority of them, dealt just with fruit flies. And what we found in the fruit fly experiments, many of which took place in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, is what it seems. In these cases, they would often find what they called incipient speciation or partial reproductive isolation. But they never found complete reproductive isolation, which is the technical definition of a new species. As long as you only have partial reproductive isolation, then there is still gene flow between the two populations, which means that there is still interbreeding, and you really don't have this reproductively isolated population, which is supposedly going to constitute new species. If I had a nickel for every time I saw the word incipient speciation or partial speciation or partial reproductive isolation, gosh, I would be a somewhat wealthy man, you know, more wealthy than I am right now, at least. So these papers would report only small degrees of reproductive isolation or partial isolation, not complete. Additionally, you would not find any significant morphological changes. There were some papers by the famous geneticist Theodosius Dobzhansky, where he would subject fruit flies to rounds and rounds and rounds of selection, and he would note at the end of the day, they remained indistinguishable morphologically, and there's nothing new. And he acknowledged that after doing all these rounds of selection, you at best found, quote, a new race or incipient species, unquote. Well, incipient, is again, it's one of those weasel words that means we found some reproductive isolation, but there's not anything close to a new species that has occurred.
So they showed a preference for reproduction, but they didn't actually show that they couldn't reproduce with whatever kind of fly it was they came from, because they're still the same kind of fly.
Yes, exactly. What we're talking about is a population would undergo artificial selection in the lab, and then it would show a statistical preference to mate with other individuals within the population
that was separated from the original population.
That's right. Within the population that was separated from the original population, but it would not be an absolute preference. It would still be willing to mate and produce viable fertile offspring, by the way, with the original population. So this was not true speciation. And what about when we did see some kind of morphological or some other change taking place? What did we observe? Well, in some of the studies, we found things like slight changes in the number of hairs on the legs of the fruit flies, or changes in the number of times per minute that a fruit fly might lick itself. And then you get females preferring, you know, one number of hairs over the other, or females preferring those males that lick themselves more often than or less often than others. And so you get, again, partial reproductive isolation based upon sexual preferences. This is called sexual isolation. And again, this is not an absolute reproductive isolation. These are just statistical preferences. Females might still mate with a male that licks himself a lot or licks himself just a little bit. But this is what we're talking about here. These are the kinds of changes and these small degrees of changes that would take place in the lab.
So aside from the weasel words, they never actually got the fruit flies to develop into a different species.
No, not
by their own definition.
Not when you define it as a reproductively isolated population. And if you look at the more important question, like was there actual large-scale biological change that took place? Well, here it's even clearer that the answer is no. You are not getting large-scale biological change when all you're changing is small differences in the number of hairs on the legs of these fruit flies. That is not going to help the Darwinian mechanism explain how significant changes can occur in organisms.
Doesn't this also have an impact because in the laboratory, it would be easier to, I would assume, control for the populations. And so in the laboratory, they're specifically focusing and forcing certain populations to breed, to weed out certain traits, whereas in nature, there would never be that kind of isolation for these even small changes to take place.
That's exactly right, David. And that's very commonly, actually, you saw this in these papers, where the kinds of studies that they were doing, the kinds of experiments that they would perform, would never take place in nature. Why in nature would you artificially select small beetle pupae from the large ones and then prevent the small ones from reproducing with the large ones? There's no reason why that would necessarily happen in nature. Why in nature would you necessarily completely separate for rounds and rounds of generations those flies which like to fly upwards in a tube at the beginning of its flight, rather than those which initially like to fly downwards in a tube when it first starts to fly? And then they artificially separate the two groups, require those two groups to undergo rounds and rounds of interbreeding. And these are the kinds of changes and the kinds of experiments and the kinds of environments that you would not see in nature.
But this is the kind of thing that you would have to do in order to make a scientific experiment, would be to isolate these populations and experiment with them. So the real relevance here is that even with the advantages of the lab, changes were quite minimal.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I'm not necessarily saying that they did something wrong using an artificial environment. That's what you have to do, even if these environments would not exist in nature. But even when you have these artificial environments where you are completely separating, you're artificially creating reproductively isolated populations. And then what you want to do is you release those populations back together and see if they will still mate with one another if there has been complete reproductive isolation. You don't find that. So even when you artificially isolate them, subject them to repeated rounds of interbreeding and selection, and then let them coexist with one another and see if they will reproduce and interbreed, you do not find speciation.
The reason this is important isn't because they did something wrong in the laboratory. It's because people that are arguing that Darwinian evolution is an absolute lock to account for the species variation that we see in the fossil record and in life itself right now, that it's the Darwinian mechanisms that have provided that species variation. And the claim is that these studies advance and solidify that theory as the absolute fact as to how that happened. And what you're describing is that they're coming up short and showing that it's still a mystery.
That's absolutely right. And in one of these fruit fly papers, the great evolutionary biologist Theodosius Dobzhansky even admitted that, quote, reproductive isolation evidently can arise with little to no morphological differentiation, unquote. So here you have him admitting that even when you have reproductive isolation, you're still not necessarily seeing any significant biological change. So how do all the biological changes in nature arise? Well, I don't think that they've demonstrated how they can arise. And even then, they're not even getting complete reproductive isolation.
You mentioned beetles, that there was one citation that experimented with beetles and tried to reproductively isolate certain beetles. How did that citation pan out?
Yeah, this was another interesting one. They took beetles of different sizes and they would just isolate them and then let them interbreed. And then they put them back together and see if they would still prefer to mate with one size versus another. And there was some reproductive isolation, but there was not complete reproductive isolation again. And morphologically, all we saw was, I think, about a milligram difference in the weight of beetle pupae. So, I mean, again, we're not talking about anything, quote unquote, new evolving. These are very small scale size differences that evolved.
Were there any animals more advanced than insects in the studies that Talk Origins cited?
Yeah, there were. Now, the vast majority of the studies cited did deal with insects, very small scale changes there. But there were a couple studies that were cited that dealt with animal hybrids being formed, where you could have two different species basically coming together to form what might be, in the best case scenario, called a third species, which is an example of supposed speciation. Now, and the fact talks about this, but the evidence really suggests that hybridization cannot be a viable mechanism for speciation in animals. One of the primary papers cited by the fact admitted that animal hybrids are quote-unquote rare organisms, and there are very good reasons why this is the case. Darwinian evolution, as many of us know, requires, at the very least, heritable variation and selection. But in the case of some of these animal hybrids, such as the fish, it's been noted that the genomes of these hybrids are not entirely heritable, because basically only one portion of the hybrid genome is passed on. In the case of these hybrid fish, only the female portion of the genome is actually heritable, and it's basically cloned from generation to generation, and then a male from a different species comes in and will provide the male portion of the genome, but that can't be passed on. So this is not necessarily a true example of speciation, because males from the original parent species are always required to maintain this line. So this is not a good example of speciation. Another problem here is that when you have hybridization, that actually tends to entail the collapse of diversity rather than the origin of new diversity. You have two species becoming one rather than one species becoming two. And that's why these types of examples have been called little more than scattered twigs at the tips of major phylogenetic branches. In other words, these animal hybrids are evolutionary dead ends where you cannot continue to evolve further into something new. And they're very rare. I mean, they're not going to be a viable mechanism for producing prevalent evolutionary change within animals. So these are certainly the exception, not the rule. And they're largely irrelevant, I think, to how new species would form within most animals.
What about what we see in the plant world? A number of studies cited by Tonk Origin deal with plants and the changes amongst plants. What did you find there?
Well, plants actually can, in some cases, be somewhat able to hybridize with one another and also to produce slightly new forms through what we call polyploidy. Now, you and I each have two sets of chromosomes. We get one set from each parent, so we're called diploid organisms. And when you have two sets, your chromosomes are called 2N, meaning you have two total sets. Now, what happens if instead of getting one set of chromosomes from each parent, you inherited both sets of your parents' chromosomes? So now you would actually have four sets of chromosomes, and you would be called tetraploid. Well, it turns out that tetraploidy is actually not extremely uncommon in plants, and sometimes tetraploidy can occur when something goes wrong during the reproductive process, and you will get slightly new variations. The 4N plants, basically, the tetraploids, can be slightly different from their 2N or diploid parents. Now, we're not talking about large-scale changes. As a matter of fact, one of the examples that we saw was in a genus called Tragopogon, and when you look at the daughter species compared to its parent species, they're still very similar. So these are not large-scale changes, but you still can see some changes that have taken place. But it's worth noting that Douglas Futuma, who is a very well-known evolutionary biologist, he has said that polyploidy, quote, does not confer major new morphological characteristics and does not cause the evolution of new genera or higher levels in the biological hierarchy, unquote. So yes, polyploidy can be a mechanism for speciation within plants, but it's not going to produce large-scale changes within plants. And so these are the sort of examples that we saw. There was one other example from plants that I found interesting. In this case, I want to note from the beginning that they only found partial post-mating reproductive isolation. So they did not have complete reproductive isolation here. So this was actually not a case of complete speciation, but they did find that some populations would be more or less resistant to copper, basically, being in the soil. And essentially, they found that this probably had a very simple genetic basis, and these changes might be caused by a single gene. But at the end of the day, this is a modest amount of biological change, very modest, you know, one gene that has slightly changed the tolerance for copper. But at the end of the day, they did not find complete reproductive isolation. And again, this was the rule that we saw throughout these papers: small-scale biological change and incomplete reproductive isolation. So I would say that if people are claiming that this fact shows that the Darwinian mechanism could produce large-scale changes in organisms and that we have lots of examples of true speciation being observed, those people are simply wrong, and the Tonk Origin fact certainly does not demonstrate otherwise.
Does the observance of small changes in plants and this way that plants can vary more so than animals, does that have any applicability to the animal kingdom?
No, I mean, plants and animals definitely operate very differently. They have very different modes of reproduction in many cases. And I think that we all know that you can hybridize plants, you can produce interesting new breeds through artificial selection. And it's possible that, you know, some of this might be taking place in nature. Although again, when we see things like polyploidy going on, we only observe, as Douglas Futuma mentioned, you know, small scale morphological changes, and you don't find things producing new genera. It's always within a genus producing slightly new species.
So the conclusion that you derived from looking into each of these studies, or as many as you could possibly find that were cited by Talk Origin, was what?
Well, again, the conclusion is that we did not see examples of true large-scale evolutionary change going on. And as far as speciation goes, when you define a species as a reproductively isolated population, arguably there were really no examples of complete reproductive isolation. Maybe a couple where there was almost complete, and those were in plants. But other than that, really, we did not see true speciation taking place, certainly not in animals.
It seems to me that what your research shows is that despite all the confidence shown that the Darwinian theory is an absolute lock and this accounts for all the different changes in species, that there's still a big mystery out there and that there's not a lot of evidence that this Darwinian mechanism is the cause of all these things.
Yeah, let me give you a funny little anecdote that came from the FAQ itself. The author of the FAQ was a graduate student at the time that he wrote the FAQ. And he reports an informal survey that seems to actually document that there is groupthink about the evidence for speciation. He writes that, quote, "I asked about 24 graduate students and faculty members in the department where I'm a student whether there were examples where speciation had been observed in the literature. Everyone said that they were sure that there were. Next, I asked them for sightings or descriptions. Only 8 of the people I talked to could give an example, and only 3 could give more than one. But everyone was sure that there were papers in the literature." Okay, well, fine. So this guy asked a bunch of people, and only 3 people could give more than one example of speciation in the literature. So when the FAQ claims that many researchers feel that there are already ample reports in the literature regarding speciation, I think that actually people are just, they believe that there are these examples, but when you dig into the literature, you find that they are not really examples.
And so it's true, they really feel it, but they don't know it.
Yeah, it's just groupthink. They all believe that, yes, somebody has figured this out. We all believe that there are these examples of clear speciation in the literature, but when you dig into the literature, it's a lot less clear. And one of the most ironic parts of this is when you actually read the papers cited by the FAQ, a number of them admit just how rare the process of speciation has been observed, if it has been observed at all. One of the papers made the striking observation, this was actually one by Theodosius Dobzhansky, the famous geneticist. He said that, quote, "We're in a situation today similar to that experienced by Darwin more than a century ago. Differentiation of species is inferred from copious indirect evidence, but has not actually been observed," unquote. And how ironic is that? And this is from actual literature being cited by the FAQ. So you dig into the papers and you find a very different story is being told.
Casey, before I let you go, how does all of this relate to the debate about intelligent design?
That's a good question. You know, I've been reading some of the responses to my response to the Talk Origin speciation FAQ on some of these feisty internet evolution blogs, where they're saying, well, this shows that, you know, intelligent design is anti-evolution. They're saying that species can't even be closely related to one another. No, that's not what I'm saying at all. The Talk Origins FAQ purports to provide evidence that shows the alleged creative power of the Darwinian mechanism. And what I'm saying is that when we actually observe in the laboratory and we actually look into the literature and ask what changes have been observed as a result of the Darwinian mechanism, it's actually very modest. And intelligent design certainly does claim that the Darwinian mechanism is very limited in what it can do. Is it possible that some of these very similar fruit fly strains or species actually are related to one another? From an ID perspective, I would say absolutely yes. I mean, it's very likely they are related to one another if you go back far enough. And it's possible that, you know, you look at many of these organisms, these plants that are similar, you look at many of these highly similar species of apple maggot flies, where you have one population that feeds off of pears and another one that feeds off of apples, and they're very similar. Is it likely that these are related to one another? Yeah, absolutely. But we have to also ask the question, what is the mechanism that caused any changes that we observe? Is it an unguided process of natural selection acting upon random mutation? And when you simulate that process in the lab, artificial selection upon variation, which might be natural or it might be induced, when you simulate that process in the lab, you are not even then able to produce true reproductive isolation, not able to produce large-scale evolutionary change. So I think in these cases, what we're finding is that the ability of the Darwinian mechanism to create large-scale change is being overstated. And that's an important finding. And this is not saying that we're rejecting the view that some species might be related, but we're not finding evidence to back up the claim that the Darwinian mechanism has this grand creative power that many people claim it does.
Theoretically, that should be relevant regardless of whether you're supported intelligent design or Darwinian evolution.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, David. I mean, my response to the Talk Origins fact doesn't say anything about intelligent design. Intelligent design is mentioned nowhere as a theory or an alternative. It's simply looking at the Talk Origins fact and asking whether or not its claims are of, you know, the creative power of the Darwinian mechanism are backed up by the literature that it cites. And the answer is that they're not backed up. And the literature it cites actually show very modest biological change, really trivial in many cases. And they do not show even the establishment of complete reproductive isolation in the vast majority of the cases I saw. So what we're seeing is that the Darwinian mechanism is losing backing, and it's whether or not intelligent design is a viable alternative, that's a separate question that we can talk about on another day.
Interested listeners can read Casey's entire report at evolutionnews.org. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of ID the Future. To learn more or to support the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, go to idthefuture.com and click the yellow donate button. This podcast is copyright 2012, the Discovery Institute. All rights reserved.